Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, and Dhamma talk that introduces the sixth week study of the concentration factors of the path. This was recorded on January 10th, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So we are discussing the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is characterized as a path of heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, and heightened concentration. And ultimately, the goal is, of course, to develop the wisdom that brushes aside the ignorance, the very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Everything is taught in that context. These virtuous factors are one of the reasons why what the Buddha taught is often treated as a religion, because obviously all religions have a moral and ethical component that they all share. And of course the Buddha was concerned that we are good citizens in the world, but more importantly the reason why these are taught, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, is as we develop concentration and we can hold in mind the unskillful aspects of right speech, action, and livelihood. In other words, we recognize when we're gossiping or maybe lying or maybe engaged in idle chatter or unnecessary chatter or acting in a way that's hurtful towards others or towards ourselves. As we're able to be mindful of that, we can very clearly see where we're craving and where we're clinging. And of course, the ultimate goal of the Buddha's teachings is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. And notice that these three factors of the Eightfold Path follow right view and right intention. And as we talked about 2 weeks ago, getting confused with all these different weeks, right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. So here we are. We're giving a very simple way of recognizing our behavior that is a reflection of craving and clinging for the sole and simple purpose of abandoning it, putting it aside, letting it go. And to develop the refined mindfulness that holds in mind the virtuous side of these behaviors. So I'll start with Matt. What do you think of this week's study? It's good to see you tonight.
I really like this week's study because for a couple reasons. One is that this sort of the virtuous factors touch on kind of the social aspects of the Dhamma, of being in relationship with people. Dhamma practice and Buddhism in general maybe has a connotation of being sort of an individualist kind of pursuit where monks are cloistered away in quiet solitude and or meditating in a cave or on top of a mountain away from people, away from the world. And if we look at really what the Buddha taught in this context, it's not about that at all. It's really about, as you said, recognizing where craving and clinging are hanging out in our social interactions, in the thoughts that we're thinking and what we're saying to ourselves about those thoughts and what we're saying to each other when we get around each other, when tough things come up. So I think that this is really important and takes it out off the cushion into the world. So I find these virtuous factors to be really big parts and pieces.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's such an important observation. This isn't something that we do. It's not a practice. Meditation is something that we do in solitude most of the time. We're here together once a week as a sangha. But the meditation practice, while it's in solitude, is to prepare us to be out in the world. It's not about being separated. It's not about abandoning the world. The entire Dhamma is developed so that we can live as fully mature human beings in the world as life unfolds. And even during the Buddha's time, even within his Sangha, they were expected to go out into the countryside. For one thing, they had to go out every day and get a bowl of food to keep alive. But they did, the exchange for that bowl of food, for that sustenance, was to teach the Dhamma. It was a mutual exchange, and they were constantly involved in the outside world. It's such an important understanding that this is not, while we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and meditation is an aspect of that refuge, it's preparation for being out in the world in a mindful and meaningful way. And again, that, why would the Buddha teach these virtuous factors if that wasn't the case? Well, Matt was talking, I was thinking about Thomas Merton. I don't know how many people have heard of Thomas Merton. He was a Christian monk and a meditator, but he also was exposed to Zen meditation and took it to heart. And one of the things that he said, he spent, I can't remember the exact time frame, I should. He spent a long time in isolation, meditating, up on a mountain. And he finally came to the realization that the great strides that he came, that he developed about understanding himself in meditation was useless unless he could take it off the mountain. And the phrase that he used was, "This is useless unless I can take it to the marketplace," meaning you have to be out in the world. What good is it to develop a peaceful and calm mind when you're not brushing up against anything that's going to show you what you're craving and clinging to? We need the world, but we need the world, we need to be in the world in a well-concentrated and mindful way. We need to have a framework for how to live in the world, and that's exactly why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, so that we had that framework. Thank you for bringing it up. What a great insight. Luke, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. Meditation practice is going well. I neglected to get to the reading this week, regretfully. I guess with craving and clinging, I really I don't have to look too far in. It's kind of right there at the surface. I don't know. I guess my pursuit, I heard an interesting thing. I'll probably butcher it, but it was a pretty simple thing. I think Wayne Dyer maybe originally said it. But it was basically like sort of your spiritual introspection, trying to look for yourself, find yourself, whatever. And he likened it to losing your keys in your apartment, basically. And none of the lights in your apartment work. So obviously you're not going to be able to find your keys. So you look out the window, and there's a street light, you know, lit up out there, and there's your car, and you think to yourself, okay, well, I'll go out there and I'll look for my keys out there. And that's as pointless as the pursuit of like kind of what I've been trying to do of trying to like master this resistance or whatever in a powerful way, in like proactively, like I'm going to do something about it right now, like fight it or something physically or something like that. Whereas just it's kind of the exact opposite of that. It's just with the stillness comes the peace.
That's great. It's beautiful. Our ego self will not relent to a full frontal attack. You know, we need to quiet our minds. The anatta, what the Buddha said, is not a self, is always looking to establish itself in every thought that occurs. And if we're fighting for it, or if we're using meditation as an escape, all we're doing is contributing to that conditioned thinking. But when we develop a well-concentrated mind through meditation, and we have the proper framework to recognize our craving and clinging, then it becomes a fairly simple matter of just staying with it. And we'll talk a little bit more about right effort later on tonight. Thank you for that. Stefan, good to see you. How are you?
I've been doing an experiment this week. Something you had said about how you can have right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness, like how you can be very mindful of something that's not appropriate and not helpful,
yeah,
was starting to seem, you know, close to home. I was noticing my mind unconsciously spending a sort of scary amount of energy, like clinging after some fairly frivolous online pastimes for myself. So this week I'm experimenting with just not doing that stuff at all. And it definitely makes a difference in the mind. Sort of like step away from the activity for a few days and the like mental noise and chatter that was associated with it kind of dies down. At least that's what's been happening for me. So that's good. And it also makes me think about how in the context of right speech, you talked about how some speech is wrong in that it's distracting. You know, it's just kind of frivolous. And I think that certainly there can be wrong actions in the same way. Like, not that they're evil necessarily, but that they're just distracting actions. Yeah. Or doing something just to take our minds off of paying attention to the world.
Yeah.
So, that's my been my experiment for the week, spending less time in pointless action.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's exactly it. To recognize those things that throughout the Pali Canon, the Buddha emphasizes the importance of recognizing our associations. Associations is simply another word for clinging. And so we associate with people, but we also associate with objects, and we associate with things that, unless we develop some mindfulness and recognize it, are usually just a distraction. And again, mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, and we can do that with anything. And that conditioned mind really wants to stay distracted, and it'll find anything, even somewhat innocuous pursuits, if they're causing distraction, they need to be recognized and abandoned. And that's when we're getting to the very subtle aspects of craving and clinging. You know, the obvious things of being addicted to food or drugs or alcohol or Facebook or anything like that, those usually fall away pretty quickly because they're so obvious. But what Stefan's talking about is some very subtle aspects of behavior that then come up when we develop that concentration and the refined mindfulness. So, thank you. Ron, good to see you tonight.
See you anyway. I really enjoy practicing this part of the path, the virtuous factors, although I've always had this thing about the word virtues. There are these neat little tests that come up like almost constantly. If you keep those three factors in mind daily, every time you open your mouth, every time you have a transaction with somebody, there's a little test there. Am I?
Yeah.
You know, is this right action? Is this right speech? And if not, why does this bother me? So there, at that point, you can start looking at what you're hanging on to, and the results of being mindful of right action, right speech, and right livelihood, they show themselves pretty quickly. Life gets much nicer once you stop causing trouble. You know,
for yourself and others.
For yourself and others.
Okay.
For me, that's been one of the bigger, I wouldn't say revelations, but pleasures of having a practice is that you can do it every time, everywhere, and it has results.
Yeah.
Enjoy it.
Yeah, the whole point of the Dhamma is to develop a lasting, peaceful and calm mind. And of course, if our behavior and thought word and deed isn't, we can't. But if we do, we can. It really is that simple. And that's how we see it. Many, 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 many students in this room and online, the first thing that they recognize and recognize their behavior or have a framework is right speech, what comes out of their mouth. And remember, right speech also has a component of what we say to ourselves. It's so important to recognize that. And we can see that very clearly when we're sitting on a cushion. And that doesn't mean we should get into analyzing these this conversation that we always have with ourselves, but simply to recognize that that's what's going on, and recognize the things that we say to ourselves. You know, do we engage in a type of self-character assassination? Are we putting ourselves down? Are we seeing ourselves in some way that is diminishing who we are in this moment? Recognize it. And what do you do with it? You don't try to figure out where it came from. You simply let it go and bring your mind into what's occurring right now. Thank you for bringing that up. Judy, good to see you.
Good evening, John. I also didn't do the meeting this week, I confess, but I'm reminded tonight about something that Matt said a while ago, because I feel very fortunate to do what I do with my work and to be with the people that I'm with. And it gives me the opportunity to use right speech. It's just you had said, Matt, I think that your work is your practice, you know, right? And I feel that way. I feel that way. So much of my day is spent practicing off the cushion that way. Because when you have someone who's putting their trust in you and or in your hands, you know, it's important to speak and to act in a way that's, you know, use the word virtuous and compassionate. So I'm just reminded tonight that I'm very fortunate to have that. And when I'm not at my office, if I'm by myself, I am finding, because my practice is going pretty well, and so I'm finding that muscle in my mind that brings me back to my breath on the cushion, but then brings me back to myself off of the cushion, is a little stronger, I think. It's happening a little more frequently, you know, that I realize where am I in my head, not somewhere I want to be. And I can take a wider view of, step back, like, what's going on in my life, and okay, it's just what's happening next. So it's good. I'm in a good place.
Sounds like it. Thank you so much. I'm glad you made it tonight. May I say what you do? Judy is an outstanding, I'm not just saying it because she's here, I've had the experience, a massage therapist. And in that position, you really have to, I mean, I've been on massage tables where the people had no idea what was coming out of their mouth. But you're in a position where what you're saying is really important, because people are real relaxed and pretty open. And so what comes out of your mouth is so important in that situation. And that's another aspect of right speech, to understand that our words have an impact on other people. They're not meaningless, especially when we're mindful of it. And we can, you know, you think about the Buddha's encounter with some pretty crazy people and murderers. And he knew just the right words to say to turn them around. And, you know, Angela Miller comes to mind, you know. Never hurt another person, again, just listening to the Buddha. What we say is very important. So thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you? Glad you're here. Andrew, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Practice is quite fun.
Good.
Meditation are just snippets of that. But it's harder to do when there are daily activities that need to be done as well. But it's helpful and something that I had experienced before. But the meditation every once in a while is
good. I'm glad you're here. Are you looking at the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path? Have you, and do you?
It's not a discussion about right speech. Or, in my personal life, my parents taught me that. It's really the old rule.
Yeah.
And I've personally not had any difficulty going beyond that very wise statement. For me, it's mostly just maintaining or working on maintaining mindfulness on a daily basis.
Yeah. Oh, and that's a key. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on tonight too. Thank you, Don. Good to see you tonight. How are you?
Great. Good to be here. Do you like what everyone has to say tonight? In this meeting for this week, a couple things that really stood out for me in my speech, I actually went highly good. Before those three things are discussed individually, there's a paragraph that describes the ego and the ego itself right before that, which I think is a really accurate description of the ego. For me, it really like hit home. It's like, oh yeah, that's what it means to me. And impermanence and how that goes with impermanence. And not only that, but kind of hard to describe, but a lot of stressors came out for me this week, so this was the virtuous factors were nice to look at, the descriptions of them, because it really helped me see where my stressors were coming from, and you know, very, very clearly, without much effort. And you know, when I'm just in a state where I'm just relaxing, letting things go, I noticed I was driving my daughter home tonight. In the car, then I just looked around and I just asked her, I said, you're on a crowded road, and it's like, do you ever think about what this looked like 500 years ago? And she said, no, not really. You know, a teenager, like a 20-year-old would answer. And I said, oh, never mind. And then I thought tonight, me to think about my relationship with when I think about my relationship, especially the social factors of this, and what comes up for me a lot is like not so much my relationship with other human beings, but my relationship with all living things. And that's something that I think kind of weighs on me sometimes, and it's hard to describe, but it has to do with, you know, the way I feel about the world I live in today. In a bigger way, and the bigger picture. Not just my relationship with other people, but my relationship with all living things. So I think it does say that in there, in the writings this week. But that's kind of what's coming up for me right now.
Good. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it isn't just other people, it's our relationship with the entire world that is important to look at, and most importantly, to not have the need for anything to be any different than what's occurring. That's really what the First Noble Truth describes. This is the way this is. Whatever is occurring is what's occurring. If we want to change anything, the only thing we can really change is our view. We can go from a wrong view to a right view, the first factor of the Eightfold Path. And then we can see things clearly, and no matter what occurs, we will be able to remain peaceful and calm and live a life of lasting peace and happiness. That's really the point. And what you're describing is going through the process of developing that. So thank you. Pete, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation, and do you have any questions or comments?
Yeah, obviously I haven't read the book. I haven't done any of the reading. But I've been listening, and right speech, right action, right livelihood. I guess the first thing I would think about is how do you determine right speech from wrong speech? And from what I've been hearing so far tonight, right speech should lead you to a calm mind, common-centered mind. Reminds me of the doctor's philosophy of first do no harm. Perhaps that's what it is.
Yeah, in a very real way, that's it. You know, and then we also have to look at there's an element of harm that we're doing for ourselves and potentially to other people by simply engaging in idle or unnecessary chatter, saying things that really don't need to be said. We're causing distraction for ourselves and other people. And this does not mean that we shouldn't live in the world, we should never ask somebody to talk about the weather or anything like that. But we need to look at our behavior and what is it, where is it taking us and where are we taking other people with it. You know, again, remember the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as a middle path. It allows us to be, in fact, it insists that we be human beings as we look at the extreme behaviors of complete sensory indulgence and complete denial of what we need. So we find a middle way in there. We're going to say in relation to where you are. We're right about in the middle of the book. There's talks that I gave this year that are on the website if you're interested in going back to the beginning and catching up. There's also another page on my website that has talks related directly to the book that is listed in the book. But if you want to catch up, I would suggest go to the page that has the talks from this year, and you'll hear the Sangha discussions that have been great.
Okay, that website is in here too. Yep. Address.
Yeah, and there's a card out there that has it. There's also a little flyer that has the weekly class schedule. There's a little booklet that describes this meditation. Please take that. On the website, there's a recording of this meditation, Shamatha Vipassana. You can download that and listen to it. And there's 6-7 years of articles and talks that relate to developing this practice within the broader framework. When you go on the site, there's a link at the top left for new visitors, and that will describe what you can find there and kind of get you going in the right direction. So
yeah.
I hope you continue to join us, and we'll see you soon. Mm-hmm. Great to have you. Bill, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Myself when I was getting distracted breathing, you know, especially when I had some negative thoughts going on. It's funny at work, I work at Giant in the seafood and meat department. I have some customers with bizarre requests. They want 0.6 pounds of fish, not a half, not 3/4, but 0.6 pounds. And they look at you funny if you don't hit it right on, you know, like cutting fish is an exact science. You know, and then just I find myself not getting upset, you know, just realizing that these people are just going to be the way they are. It's my reaction to them that I can control.
Yep.
And even when I talk to my kids, you know, I don't speak about my ex in an ill fashion at all. You know, I may have all these thoughts raging through my mind and want to dump it on them, but I hold all those back and just make sure I have positive speech for my children. So I'm enjoying it. Yeah, I mean, just from the last week and going through the meditation, just, you know, having you say, you know, you have a thought in your mind, you know, realize it and then get back to breathing. I've been doing that all week long.
Good for you.
And chill. I feel really serene. It's nice.
Yeah, the practical benefits are there pretty quick, aren't they? You know, we just start gaining control of our thinking and everything changes. The person looking for that 0.6 pound of flounder or fluke or whatever they were looking for, that's all part of the First Noble Truth, you know. And I'm serious.
Yeah.
Other people are part of dukkha, the disappointing, unsatisfactory nature of life. And we can understand that. The more we develop our understanding of our own dukkha, our own suffering, then we can understand where it's coming from in other people. And we don't have to react. We can understand that.
I mean,
and
I have one customer, he's like, 0.6, 0.8, and then last week I was a little annoyed at it, but this week I knew exactly what to do, because I just saw him coming, and I cut the fish just the way he liked it, and he was happy. Usually these are older people, I mean older.
Yeah.
I can't eat that much, a tenth of a pound off, oh my God, I can't eat that much.
The First Noble Truth. Thank you, Billy.
Thank you.
Joe, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to be here. Well, I did the reading. Sitting is, I do it. My mind has recently been very busy. I think the longer, the more frequently I sit, the week, as the week's turning to a month or so, it's harder for me to do. My mind's very busy. And I notice that when I study, because I'm studying another subject, and when I'm with my motorcycle, I'm not distracted. I'm very focused. There's no noise or chatter. You know, I'll be accomplishing a task either way in either circumstance, but I notice the quality of my mind when I'm doing those things. It's quiet. But when I sit, I'm having a hard time being mindful of my reading. And although I'm not touching on the reading, because my question is, I guess, is there a difference between thinking a thought and being aware of it, and I don't know why I'm having a hard time being mindful when I sit. It's I don't know that it's a problem. You know, I'm going to continue to do it, and then hopefully I'll grow out of it, maybe, or whatever. But it's distracting that it's distracting.
Yeah. So. Many people say exactly the same thing, and what you're experiencing is you're just simply becoming more mindful of what's occurring in your mind. It's not that the chatter is picking up, you're just noticing it more. And this is really the first time that you've looked at your own mind. As you... Now, let me go back. You mentioned the motorcycle, and when you're doing something like that, you're well-focused. You are well focused in your meditation, you just don't realize it. And I can qualify that by saying you are recognizing when you're caught up in your thoughts and you are coming back to your breath, correct?
Yeah, but it's constant.
That constancy is a meditation practice. And for now, let that be enough. It's enough just to engage in the method and understand as you deepen that practice and develop the broader framework, your mind will calm down. It's part of it. But it's not just meditation. It's also developing the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. And I'll talk a little bit more about that and how we do that tonight, too. But don't be discouraged. Many, many people say exactly the same thing. You're just now becoming familiar with your own mind, recognizing that it's distracting. And thank you for bringing that up. Lorna, good to see you. That was very significant for you, though, wasn't it? Just to begin to recognize your self-talk and what you were saying to yourself. Even more so than what you were saying to other people, at least at first. Yeah. Started changing everything. So thank you for bringing that up. Let me ask Ryan, or invite her on screen once more if she wants to. Oh, wait a minute, looks like there's someone else here. Yeah. Ryan, if you want to join us, please do so. And there's someone else has joined us too, but I don't see the link. Sorry about that. And sorry for getting a little distracted here. Well, so let me talk about what we'll be studying this next week. They're known as the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path: right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And again, notice that by using those words, there's such a thing as wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong meditation. Another word to use would be skillful or unskillful, as opposed to, you know, skillful effort or unskillful effort, etc. So everything the Buddha taught was in the context of the Four Noble Truths, and the Eightfold Path is a path to develop an understanding of suffering and our contribution to suffering, and to bring that to cessation. So right effort is the effort to develop that, to actually develop it. And it makes sense then that right effort is first that we need to put some effort into, meaning we need to have a meditation practice, we need to establish it and maintain it. And you know that as we do this, as we do it here, I recommend that when you're starting out, you start with short periods of meditation, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, and gradually build on that. And if you can do that twice a day, that's the beginning of right effort. And then the other aspect of right effort is to do what we're doing, what the book writes about, what I wrote about in the book, and what we do in class, is to put your effort into developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And how do we do that? We do it first in the resting and the concentration that we begin to develop in a meditation practice. And that allows us to hold in mind the refined mindfulness that allows us to be aware of the Eightfold Path as the framework for our life. So we had a very, really good discussion about that. We're recognizing when we might be engaged in wrong speech or unskillful speech, and we come back into right speech. When the Buddha taught mindfulness as it relates to the Eightfold Path, he taught it in a very simple and direct way. When engaged in wrong view, enter and remain in right view. When engaged in wrong intention, enter and remain in right intention, etc. When engaged in wrong speech, be mindful of it. Let it go and practice right speech. Very simple and direct. But we need to first have this intellectual engagement with the Eightfold Path. None of us have heard of the Eightfold Path, and certainly none of us have put that into practice until we came to meditation, most of us anyway. You might have heard of the Eightfold Path here and there. But even in modern Buddhism, the Eightfold Path is often diminished or completely dismissed as far as a useful practice. So many of us are engaging in this for the first time in our lives. And we all know what right speech, right action, etc. is. But because we've never looked at it before, it's unfamiliar as a behavior. It takes a while to integrate it into our lives. We just have a natural resistance to learning and integrating anything that we're unfamiliar with. So the more that we do it, and the reason why I talk about it often, the reason why we're going through the course, is to integrate the Eightfold Path. That's the other side of right effort. Meditation, and then the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness is the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, and of course that implies wrong mindfulness. And Ram hit it really good. We can hold in, and Stefan too, we can hold in mind anything. It's still mindfulness. I keep using myself as an example. For many, many years, the only thing I could hold in mind was the bottom of a vodka bottle, and I wanted to get down there as quick as I could. That was an aspect of mindfulness that almost killed me, and it's killed an awful lot of people that I've known. But that's mindfulness. So mindfulness alone is not the greatest thing in the world, even though it's kind of the modern pop religion. Everybody wants to be mindful. What we hold in mind is the most important thing. And I'll say it this way. What we hold in mind will determine the life that we live. What kind of life do you want? Do you want a life that develops lasting peace and happiness? Be mindful of the Eightfold Path and these factors of the Eightfold Path. And the only way that most of us can do it is to first deepen our concentration. It's from that developed skill of concentration that we're able to accomplish the task of that refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. So right mindfulness is a very powerful and significant understanding. What we hold in mind is going to determine our experience. And if we can hold in mind, or the more that we can hold in mind, the entire Eightfold Path, the quicker and more direct will be our awakening or our developing full human maturity. And then the last factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation. And of course, the implication is that there's such a thing as wrong meditation. And I'm not putting down meditation in general. Well, maybe I am. But as it relates to the Eightfold Path, the Buddha taught one specific type of meditation, and it's Shamatha Vipassana meditation. So I'm not saying don't ever do any other type of meditation if you find it useful. But if you're doing a different type of meditation, do that separately from Shamatha Vipassana meditation so that you're clear about what you're developing. So Shamatha Vipassana meditation is there to deepen concentration. It's not there to have experiences. It's not there to escape. It's not to have any kind of astral travel or anything like that. It's not for mystical experiences. It's for the very practical purpose of deepening concentration so that we can hold in mind the refined mindfulness that's necessary to develop the entire Eightfold Path. I can tell you from my own experience, I've tried many, many different meditation methods, and they all left me lacking until I really understood what the Buddha taught as a meditation practice and, as importantly, why he taught it. Because up until that point, I was, even though it was mostly subconscious and very subtle with me, every meditation I was doing up until that point that I had this understanding was to have some type of effect. And sometimes it was a rather mundane effect, but it was still looking for something other than deepening concentration. So Joe, you were talking about that difficulty that you're having. Well, what you're lacking right now is concentration, isn't it? And what you will develop pretty quickly, I would say, is concentration. Concentration is a calm and peaceful mind. It's what we're looking for in meditation, except when we're looking to have an experience of something other than concentration, it becomes very elusive. It's like the carrot on the stick. We're always chasing something. Joe.
May I ask again if there's a difference between having a thought and being aware of one?
Only in the sense that, and I'm not quite sure the context that you're seeing it, but you may be describing that having a thought with a reaction to it is something a little bit different than just simply being mindful of a thought arising. And so what you're...
Where when I'm caught up in my thinking, because there would be more than one thought, and, you know, like you catch yourself completely off topic, you're not meditating any longer.
Yeah.
So you go back to mindfulness. And then sometimes I can stay there, like it's brief, it's very brief, but I'm noticing this transitory thought that I'm not, I don't know if I'm thinking it or if I'm catching nipping it in the bud, and I don't know, maybe it doesn't even matter.
At that point, it doesn't matter. Again, we can get too analytical in our meditation, and there's a lot of meditation practices that even ask you to do that. Whatever comes up, look at it, where's it come? It's not helpful in deepening your concentration. So during meditation, during your Shamatha Vipassana meditation practice, whatever comes up, recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. It's not the time to figure out anything. What you can do, if you have a recurrent theme that comes up in meditation, you can put aside a separate time to quiet your mind and simply contemplate what that is, but do that separate from meditation. And you might gain some insight, but I wouldn't go too far with that either. It's off our cushion that we're able to implement the concentration that we've deepened, that we've developed on our cushion, and we recognize our behavior, thoughts, words, and deeds, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, as a reflection of the state of our mindfulness. And that's where it becomes useful. It's too easy to get caught up in our own conditioned thinking. It's another reason why, be careful using this word, but I'll use it, why focusing on just some general type of insight, meaning insight into everything that occurs, this is what's going on, I need to get to the bottom of it, or I need to figure it out, that doesn't lead to deepening concentration. It's just another distraction. Meditation is for deepening concentration, at least right meditation or skillful meditation, as the Buddha taught. So if you look at your meditation practice just that way, you'll greatly decrease your frustration at not being able to simply be mindful of your breath. And I can tell you, somebody asked me a while ago, and it kind of put me back on my heels because I was never asked that question. This is probably a year ago now, but for the first time, somebody says, well, how long can you be mindful of your breath? And I had no answer because I never thought about it because that wasn't my goal. Except when I did put some thought to it, maybe it's 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, maybe sometimes 8. I can tell you that after 37 years of meditating, I'm not just mindful of my breath for 20 minutes straight, but I don't care because I can tell you that my concentration has greatly increased, and that's the point. And it's greatly increased to the point not I don't have a superhuman type of concentration. That's not necessary. In fact, that would kind of take me away from what's most important is to develop a well-concentrated mind that can hold in mind my own life so I can be present for my life. And I've been able to develop that through this simple practice, and I never was able to develop it anymore because I was always looking for an experience. You know, I mean, I can tell you some places that I traveled in my own mind during so-called guided meditations, and they were incredible experiences, and I look at them now, and I think they were just suggestions. You know? So the meditation method is for deepening concentration. Whenever we recognize that we're caught up in thoughts, whether it's one thought that keeps coming up or we keep coming back to this story of our life, recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. And as we do that, we're building that concentration that allows us to develop the refined mindfulness of the entire Eightfold Path. It's not just meditation, but everything is grounded in meditation. And so then I'll talk a little bit about what we've looked at in week 2 with the 4 foundations of mindfulness. The 4 foundations of mindfulness are taught to develop a dispassionate response to what's occurring in meditation. Feelings arise, we recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. Thoughts arise, sometimes driven from feelings, we recognize it, come back to the sensation of breathing. And in the end, then that 4th foundation of mindfulness comes in play, and I say it at the end of every meditation, notice the quality of your mind, be at peace with your mind. And what that means is if in your meditation or off your cushion, if you've been reacting to feelings and thoughts that are occurring in your life, the quality of your mind will be agitated. It's enough to simply recognize that. At the end of your meditation, notice the quality of your mind and be at peace with it. And know that this entire practice is to develop, ultimately, a foundational mindfulness that is always resting in equanimity. That's the point of the Dhamma. And from what we've all talked about here, that's exactly where we're moving to. We're developing the skills necessary to accomplish that final task of lasting peace and happiness. So you'll read that chapter this week on the concentration factors, and we'll discuss it. And next week I'll introduce week 7, the 3 marks of existence. And I may separate that into 2 weeks, but I'll look at that. And I'm definitely going to separate the 8th week chapter on dependent origination and the 5 clinging aggregates, because there really is at least 2 weeks in there, maybe 2 months, but we'll do it in 2 weeks. So any questions or comments? Well, I want to thank Ryan, and I think it was Laith that joined us online. I hope you can join us next week, and maybe we'll figure out why you couldn't get invited on screen. And Ryan, I'll probably talk to you. Ryan's from Crowdcast, so I'll probably email you tomorrow. So, but thank you for joining. We'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.